Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everyone. This is Carla Campbell, your host for this evening. Shout. We were talking about that earlier in terms of using this particular title for the show, and I think it is appropriate for us to shout it out, to have conversations about situations and circumstances around our communities and in our everyday life, right? And so today I decided that I want to delve into this discussion with regards to what's been happening in the last couple of days, in the last couple of weeks, actually, and with regards to the Supreme Court. And so, look, let me just be blunt with you. Let's just get into the conversation here. Yes, this whole situation with regards to affirmative action, I think this is something, a topic that we really need to delve into and that we need to have conversations, but also have some ideas as to how we move forward. I was in an NAACP meeting just a couple of days ago. They declared at the same day in which this hearing came forth from the Supreme Court regarding affirmative action. And so what I'm going to do is give you the history, and let's kind of give you a backdrop of what affirmative action is and what it isn't. And so let's go here with regards to affirmative action. Let me give you the history with it. So affirmative action in the United States, and we all have heard about it. We all know about it. Some of us benefited. Many of us have benefited from it. And so affirmative action in the United States, which is an active effort to improve employment or educational opportunities for members of minority groups and for women. Affirmative action began as a government remedy to the effects of longstanding discrimination against such groups and has consisted of policies, programs, and procedures. And I want you to pay attention to that: policies, programs, and procedures that give limited preference to minorities and women in job hiring, admissions to institutions of higher education, the awarding of government contracts and other social benefits. The typical criteria for affirmative action are race, disability, gender, ethnic origin, and age. That's affirmative action. When was affirmative action implemented? Affirmative action was initiated by the administration of President Lyndon Baines Johnson in 1963 through 1969. That was during his presidency, in order to improve opportunities for African Americans while civil rights legislation was dismantling the legal basis for discrimination. The federal government began to institute affirmative action policies under the landmark of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, and it was an executive order in 1965. Businesses receiving federal funds were prohibited from using aptitude tests and other criteria that tended to discriminate against African Americans. Affirmative action programs were monitored by the Office of Federal Contract Compliance and the Equal Opportunity Commission. Subsequently, affirmative action was broadened to cover women and Native Americans, Hispanics, and other minorities, and was extended to colleges and universities and state and federal agencies. So since the onset of this policy, back in 1969, under Lyndon Baines Johnson's administration, there have been several reverse discrimination lawsuits. So I want you guys to understand this. The reason why we're here today is because we've had so many hearings. The Supreme Court has had so many hearings regarding reverse discrimination, starting with in 1970s The use of racial quota and minority set-aside led to court challenges of affirmative action as a form of reverse discrimination, and the first major challenge was the case of Regents of the University of California versus Bake, 1978, in which the Supreme Court ruled 5-4 that quotas may not be used to preserve places for minority applicants if white applicants are denied a chance to compete for those places. That was 1978. So, look, that was just the beginning. 2 years later, a fragmented court upheld a 1977 federal law requiring that 10% of funds for public works be allotted to qualified minority contractors. In 1989, we also had another case in the Anderand Constructors versus PENA in 1995, the court ruled that federal affirmative action programs were unconstitutional unless they fulfilled a compelling governmental interest. Also, 1996, here's another case. California culminated in the passage in 1996 of the California Civil Rights Initiative, Proposition 209, which prohibited all government agencies and institutions from giving preferential treatment to individuals on the basis of race or sex. The Supreme Court effectively upheld the constitutionality of Proposition 209 in November 1997 by refusing to hear a challenge to its enforcement. Here we go again, 1998. The Supreme Court also upheld a lower court ruling that struck down as unconstitutional the University of Texas Affirmative Action Program, arguing in Hopewood versus University of Texas Law School that there was no compelling state interest to warrant using race as a factor in admissions decisions. Afterwards, there were further legislative and electoral challenges to affirmative action in many parts of the country. Here's another case that is very familiar, and many of us are familiar with the Bollinger decision in 2003, Bollinger versus the University of Michigan, where this individual was denied a law school entrance. And the Supreme Court reaffirmed the constitutionality of affirmative action, which is Grutter versus Bollinger, though it also ruled that race could not be the preeminent factor in such decisions. We also have Gratz versus Bollinger. That case continued. We also have Fisher versus University of Texas at Austin. This is in 2013. Also in 2022, once again, the same case, Grutter versus Bollinger, Students for Fair Admissions Incorporated versus President and Fellows of Harvard College, and Students for Fair Admissions versus University of North Carolina. In both cases, the plaintiff argued that the Grutter court's ruling was grievously wrong. So we can go on and on with this, but this case has been challenged since the onset of the policy being implemented during the Civil Rights Movement, and the Civil Rights Movement in which Black people were fighting for their rights, establishing themselves as citizens in this country, wanting equal and fair treatment. We can also go back to the Board of Education, Brown versus Board, right? Starting out with that, Brown versus Board of Education. So this fight for equal opportunity, this fight for the establishment of one maintaining their own privilege, has now come to a decision in which affirmative action has been dismantled. No longer will institutions be allowed to make a decision based on race. And so I am opening up the conversation, and I see a number of you are called in, but let's delve into this. We have to look at both sides of the coin, right? And I know that some people are like, wait a minute, hold up, Carla. I'm one of those, I try to be as diametrically opposed as I possibly can, to be fair, right? For those who seek out equality in an environment in which one holds the privilege, right? Versus minority groups who do not have that privilege. I know Michelle Obama put out a message the same day about her acceptance into Princeton and her experience there at Princeton and how she felt as if people were just looking at her as if she was a token, when she knew she worked very hard to get where she is. And so, we have to consider that. I mean, it's not that people are asking for a handout. People are saying, the minority group, African Americans, are saying, we're worthy. We work just as hard. We have the ability. We're just as smart. We're not asking for a handout. But because of the odds are stacked against African Americans, the odds are stacked against African American students, young people, people of color, the odds are stacked. And so therefore, affirmative action was trying to even out the playing field to give people an opportunity, whereas they would not have received that opportunity based on race. And since we live in a very racialized society, because race matters, as Cornel West puts it, race matters in this country. And so if you do not have the credentials, or if you do not have the economical support system, right, if you don't meet those criteria financially or racially, or if we can even say gender-wise, then what will this decision, what impact will it have on our institutions, especially in higher education, but also how will it affect corporations and their choosing of people and the number of people that they hire into their companies, such as engineering firms and in the health field? How will this all play out? And so I see that 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 of you are calling in, and so I want us to have this conversation. So I'm going to go with caller. I'm going to go with this caller here. And I want you guys to just talk to me what your feelings are about this. What are your thoughts on it? What can we do about it? Okay, so we're going with caller one. Caller, are you there? Hello? Hello? Yeah, what are your thoughts on that?
My thoughts on, I agree with you. I think that this is you're going to start seeing affirmative action or the loss of affirmative action being applied to other aspects of society, like you said, as far as jobs or maybe the military. Or medical health care.
I think
it's going to start. I mean, just this starting with not being able to go to these universities, you know, them abolishing or stopping affirmative action, I think that's going to start the cycle in which other industries, which were at first required by law in some ways to include minorities, I think now they don't have to do that anymore. I don't think if you're not forced to do anything, at least by law, then I don't think you are going to, because that was the reason why the law was put in place in the first place, because people weren't hiring women.
Absolutely, because it became a buffer. It was
correct,
something to help. Because without it, And I can put this out here. You guys can tell me, you know, without it, hey, would the opportunities have been given to Clarence Thomas, for example? I hate to bring him up, but I'm gonna bring him up because he's on the bench, right? I mean, he benefited from affirmative action, whether he wants to admit it or not. He benefited from affirmative action. So, I mean, it was a buffer. It was a plateau put in place so that minority groups can benefit as well, or to give them opportunity. And so you're absolutely right. So how will this unravel in other institutions? So not just higher education, how will this now unravel with regards to work and corporations and their hiring practices? So you're absolutely right. Thank you so much. Let's see. You have something to add?
Okay. I just said, I think, can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes. I just think that also with affirmative action, I think it just pretty much applies, like you said, to minorities or, you know, the other, you said minorities or gender or young people.
I think it applies to them.
Yeah. Yeah, primarily I say more or less minorities because it's pretty much helped white women from what I've heard on television. But I think I think the same thing is networking. I mean, with us it's called affirmative action. With them it's called networking. That's how they get their jobs. It's who you know. Mm-hmm. Get into these places is who you know. Same thing.
So would that also since you've mentioned that, would that also apply to legacy, you know, students who are able to go to Harvard because their parents went to Harvard, right? The legacy plan.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. The parents. Yeah. The same thing.
And shouldn't affirmative action be? Now that you mention it, it should also be a buffer for that too, where it shouldn't just be for the elite or for the privileged. I don't know. I mean, I think in some ways it perpetuated itself in spite of affirmative action. So this is why we're where we are today.
Yes,
Thank you so much. Okay, I'm going to go to the next caller. Okay. Caller? Yes. Hello? Hello?
Hello?
Yes.
Hello?
Yes.
Yes,
we can hear you.
The decision is going to affect even, I think, students who are not college age, high school, elementary. I mean, it's going to be so widespread that I'm not sure that we will totally know how to handle the situation.
So you think it's going to become, it's just lit a fire.
Right.
It's lighting a bonfire, so it's going to spread into other institutions.
Yes.
Even though there are institutions and companies and colleges that are practicing DEI, do you think they will give up that DEI work in terms of bringing in diversity into their companies or bringing in diversity into their colleges?
I think funding may cause them to, at least on the surface, do minimal, whatever, just enough to keep the funding is what I'm thinking could occur.
Yeah. So let me ask you this. So since you mentioned that, do you think that the federal government will now pull back on its enforcement with regards to federal funding to organizations that do not comply to the hold equity equal opportunity, because I know that the hearing that took place and the ruling on affirmative action has taken place, but how would that affect companies and organizations that are already practicing that? Will that mean that they will stop practicing that?
I think that's the question. That's the question that I'm wondering about. But I'm thinking because their funding will be affected, they may say to us that they're pulling back only because they have to. But I'm not sold on that idea that's the only reason. I think the only reason they were in a lot of cases. Working with and assisting minorities was because of the funding. So in that case, then, if they're going to lose money or funding, if they continue, I would say they're going to pull back.
Going
to pull back.
That was a meeting that we also, when I went to that NAACP meeting, that was one of the things that they said, that hopefully the DEI work will continue even more so now than ever, that, you know, the whole thing of equity and inclusion will continue to go forward even more so now than ever because of this hearing. Hoping it will. Yeah.
Well,
I
hope that it will, but right now my faith is a little shaky.
Yeah, I know. I totally understand. And it's everything from the Voters' Rights Act being dismantled to now affirmative action being dismantled, all the things that, you know, African Americans fought for, died for, bled for, all of it is being dismantled. And it's concerning. And but all we can do is, you know, I can only speak for myself. I have to maintain my faith and continue to do the work, even as an instructor at a higher education, you know, institution. So, but we can't give up hope. It's sad to say we got to get back in the fight, but we never really left the fight. The fight was still there, and so I don't know. Okay, I got another person. We got like four or five people. Okay, let's go to this caller here. Okay, caller. Hello? Are you there?
Can you hear me?
Yes, come on.
Okay, I believe that the court is an elitist court and has no idea what they're doing or why we even have many of these laws on the books. When we look at these nine Supreme Justices, only three of them have ever attended public schools. And so the elitist action that's taking place there, these people aren't in touch with what's going on. Of the nine justices, only one has ever defended anybody. So we have a gap to start with. Now, I would argue that we go back earlier to the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments.
Yeah,
and these were placed there to give minority groups an a leg up so that they could catch up with what everyone else has done. And when we look at that and we go back to that point of time, Ketanji Brown Jackson, a dissenting opinion on a case, said that the reason that we had the 14th Amendment in the first place was to make up for that difference that's taken place. Because we were over here 200 years before we ever started getting the opportunity. Now, when Rutherford B. Hayes was elected president of the United States, he and Tilden were in a tie. Tilden actually won the popular vote. But when it came down to making backroom deals, Rutherford B. Hayes was put into office And one of the conditions was that he removed the troops from the South. They were there to make sure that people had the opportunity to vote, that they had all of the rights and privileges granted to them. Now, when we look at Woodrow Wilson is not our friend. There were people in the government that were in supervisory positions because they had earned them. Woodrow Wilson, a Southerner, came in and fired them because of their minority status. He is the one that came in and put petitions in the rooms so that the blacks and whites were separated. He is the one that put up the separate restrooms. Woodrow Wilson is also the one that did damage by requiring a photo be on your application so people didn't have to waste time reading it. They could just throw it in the round file as soon as they saw that picture. We go through a period of time where at one point you had to list whether you had even been arrested. Now, how many black people during most of this period of time have not been arrested or subjected to harassment by the police? Very few. This is why we have these laws that were placed on the books for a specific purpose. The only people that I think have it or have an understanding of what's taking place and the harm that can be done are Ketanji Brown Jackson, who wrote a dissenting opinion, Sotomayor,
which was brilliant, that dissent. Yes, that dissent by Ketanji Brown. Yes.
And Elena Kagan, who did not write a third dissenting opinion, but she went along with those three. And so what has happened, the members of the Supreme Court lied to us, and we saw it. Millions of people saw it. And what happened is they were asked a direct question, do you believe in stare decisis? And stare decisis is basically how much do you believe on past precedent? And they all said, yeah, we believe in it. We believe in it until we get a chance to shove it down somebody's throat. And that's what they did. This was a manipulated thing, and this is why the rating of the Supreme Court is so low in America.
Yeah.
Because they have reversed things. They went through the Dobbs decision, which overturned Roe v. Wade. Now, some people, I'm sorry to offend you if Clarence Thomas is your uncle or something, but that clown is one of the worst people ever placed on the Supreme Court. And he is saying that we can go back and look at things like Plessy v. Ferguson. And most people need to understand the significance of Plessy v. Ferguson, because Plessy did not even look white. One of his eight grandparents was black, and so by law, he is black, but he didn't have hair, color, eyes, anything that would let you know. It was a setup in order to show how stupid it was that a streetcar conductor had to determine your race so where you could sit. And this is the legacy of what we have. And Clarence Thomas is saying we ought to go back and look at that. And that would reverse what Brown reversed. So we have a situation there. Because
that's why I brought it up, Brown versus Board of Education, because Plessy, right, versus all of that was that case, that entire case in itself is what brought us to where we are today with, in terms of equal, what they said, separate but equal in terms of education. And
Plessy established the separate but equal doctrine, yes.
Yes, but it wasn't equal.
Never has been.
No, absolutely. And that has been the fight ever since. It hasn't.
It's been separate but not equal.
Absolutely. And that's what we've been fighting. This is what the fight is all about. The equity,
right.
The opportunity, nobody's asking for a handout. No one's saying, hey, you know, every black person or whatever, you know, tokenize this, that, and other. No. People who rightfully earn, who have the aptitude, who have the fortitude to be accepted into a Princeton, and if they happen to be black, that shouldn't be the, I think what they're trying to say is that shouldn't be the final decision. The decision is I happen to be black because otherwise I wouldn't be given the opportunity, but aptitude-wise, I'm capable, I have the ability, I just want the opportunity. And so that was my, that's my understanding of what that is. And the reason
now,
why...
When we look at some of these aptitude tests, they are slanted. And you, people wonder, how can such a test be slanted? At one time, there was a question on there, basically, who is... You know, who's the greatest? And among the choices were Washington and Lincoln. Black people choose Lincoln. That was not the right answer, according to the clowns that made up the test. And so we can sneak in a lot of that based on what you are knowledgeable of surrounding you. So it is possible for that to be wrong. And when we had COVID, a lot of them dropped some of these standardized tests.
Yes, they did. And
it hasn't harmed them.
It didn't
now, when we look at some of the decisions, and I'm going to bring up the one on where you can deny people services based on same-sex couples being married, that's not even one that the Supreme Court should take. They didn't have standing. Nobody was harmed. It was a fake case, and they have acknowledged. They say in their acknowledgement of who they are that they don't take those cases, but these clowns are doing it. That's how they can lie about the stare decisis and everything else. And, you know, when we look at what's the guy that likes the beer and stuff, you know, these are who we have making these decisions, and I think it's absolutely 100% wrong. Anyway, I'll give somebody else a chance to say something.
Yeah, let me go ahead and take this other caller, okay?
Otherwise, I'll tell you how I really feel about it.
All right, caller. The next caller, here we are. Are you there?
You might call out the area code because I'm not sure that they can see what you see.
404. Hello? Are you there, caller? Okay, I'll go to the next. Okay, hello, caller. Next caller.
Well, good afternoon. And as I was listening, my position was validated. And I couldn't care less about the Supreme Court. I classify that affirmative action and the rest of these programs that they came up with was basically set up to destroy the structure that was in our community. Our communities are in a shambles now because all of a sudden we could go to the white school. Look at where the black colleges are. Black schools, I went to HBCU. I was very able to rub shoulders with people in Washington, D.C. at the federal and the district government level. And the other, we have a student, a classmate who wound up being the president of the med school there in Atlanta. Now, all I'm saying is that I couldn't care less about affirmative action. I see what the divine spirit is doing is telling us, develop your own. You cannot trust other people to take care and educate your children. Mm. And if we look at it historically, Tulsa, Oklahoma, been there. I saw what they did. Mm. I saw how it looked like a barren land now. They went in there and they just killed black people, people of color. And you look at Rosewood. You look at, I'm in North Carolina, you just go down to Wilmington. They just killed the people because they were in power and they were mad and they went out and killed them.
Mm.
That's what we are fighting. I say let's deal with solutions. And the solution is let's go and build up our own black schools. I graduated in 66, and I look at what happened after then. that was around the time whenever they started the brain drain. White schools opened the doors and they let us come in. They took the leaders of the smartest black students and put them in the white schools, and the Polo School College that I went to, it deteriorated because the top school students were going over to the white schools. And all I'm saying is, let us forget white people. Let us forget white institutions. We have our own. We need to develop our own. I'm not saying now, don't get me wrong, I'm not saying that the money isn't important.
Yeah.
But what I am saying is this. If we spend our money in our community, in our institutions, they will be better than the ones that we are looking at over the fence. Oh, that grass is greener. Over here. Go ahead.
That is the argument that Booker T. Washington and W.E.B. Du Bois had, right? Because W.E.B. Du Bois was like, you know, we need to integrate. W.E.B. Du Bois was, you know, the first person of color to attend Harvard, right? So that, and this whole, also founder of NAACP, which was also integrated. Now, Booker T. Washington was like, no, we need our own. And so I'm listening to what you're saying, looking at it historically and what has happened and what has taken place, that historically African-Americans have had to establish their own in order to prove themselves, have had to because they weren't accepted into the white colleges, right? They weren't accepted into white institutions. So they
not established white churches.
Or
not
churches.
White churches either.
Absolutely.
Let's don't leave the church out.
And it's still segregated to this day. The church is still is one of the most segregated places you can go. So my question to you is this, when we're talking about coming up with resolutions, because the one thing I can say in terms of the institution I represent, we've begin to open up to HBCU colleges. And so I'm wondering if now will this open up the opportunities for HBCUs to grow or maybe receive more funding so that they could better and even more so have facilities to educate their own. But what I'm seeing is that how states are stepping into some of the HBCU colleges and pouring money into it, but now they're like, hey, you need to open it up to everyone to come to your college. You know, you will give you the funding to establish this, considering it's considered a state college now. You need to open doors for others to be able to come to your institution without seemingly being discriminatory because it is HBCU.
I agree wholeheartedly because you look at Bowie. Bowie was whenever I was in school, I graduated in 66. Bowie was a rundown black school, HBCU. Now you look at Bowie State. It is now, they got a light rail stop near. It's a commuter school. And if you look at Bluefield and West Virginia, there's a college out there. It is not no longer HBCU. It's predominantly, from what I understand, it's predominantly non-African-American now. But yeah, that's going to happen. And I saw it happen in the church with the United Methodist. And they dismantled the central jurisdiction, which was a black church and a white church. And the congregation went down, their property, they lost their property, they lost their identity. And that's what this is all about. When we look at it from a socio-psychological perspective, if a people do not have an identity, they're lost and they are defeated. And that's what this is all about. And I'm looking at it. I grew up in the South, between the South and the North, on a farm in the South and then the city in the North. And I saw the whole thing. And I go now to where my parents had bought a house in 1960. They were the first black, they were the second black to buy in that community, was able to buy in that community. Well, now it's about white again. All I'm saying is, you know, we need to begin to look at who we are and what we are. And lastly, from a spiritual perspective, through my spiritual lens, the problem is black people turned away from their first love, which was the Creator. That was what our ancestors did. Ancestors' children was not allowed to go to white schools. Our ancestors petitioned God. God made a covenant with them, and God started generating, spinning off HBCUs. And most of them were part of some religious system that was predominantly black. And we turned from there to the Supreme Court and to the White House. And both of those institutions have turned their back on us and left us out there in the cold. It's like you told a person, okay, we're going to get you a new suit. Now you just take off, strip off everything down to your undies, and you come on over here and get this new suit. Well, you're never going to get the new suit. And here you left standing out there with your undies on. And that's what I just saw to see from a spiritual perspective. And I see the divine spirit is saying, now, okay, y'all went over there, y'all tried it, and they came up with this foolishness to lead y'all over there. Now, I'm going to take back and give you back what I gave you. And I just see God is trying to tell us he's doing an old thing a new way and asking us, do we not perceive it? And we got to start thinking solution. Keep whipping a dead horse. The horse is dead. He's not getting up.
So my question, and since you mentioned that, you said the dead horse is beaten, it's not getting up. So what is the representation of that dead horse?
It's fool around expecting people that don't look like you gonna have your best interest at heart. It's not gonna happen. That's one reason why I had problems with integration. And I looked at it strictly. And people can say I'm racist, I don't care. But I looked at it, I said, now, if I send my son over there to that school, well, first I said, okay, they send their son over here to me, anybody, and I got a son. I'm going to take care of my son at all costs. So I'm sending my son over there to them. They're going to take care of their son before they take care of my son.
Yeah.
At the expense of my son's whole growth. So that was one of the reasons why I just rejected integration. But I'm a minority within a minority when it comes to that. So
that could be changing. I mean, that could be something. It could be something that is igniting people of color to begin to understand. Okay, wait a minute. I mean, where else can you go? You know, if you know they don't have your back, so you turn to your community, right? You turn to those that are experiencing what you're experiencing, coming together as a group, as one. And I think that's where we lack that It's not that we can't do it, because we can do it. We've done it several times over. You
That's
mentioned
right.
it. Rosewood, you mentioned it. You know, these different communities in Oklahoma. So it's not that it can't be done. It can be done. It's just how much do you need, what else do you need to push you in that direction to say, hey, wait a minute, we need to come together and do our own thing. How much more do you need to go through? How many more police brutality, how much more police brutality do you need to go through? How much more inequity in housing and jobs and all that that you need before you make that decision? Okay, well, you know what? Let's build our own. And Hello? Yes.
I agree with the previous caller. The only problem I have with that is it's not just people who don't look like you. It's people who do look like you who still think that white is right. There's too many black people now that if it's not white, it's not right. And they don't put the best interest of their own kind ahead. They put the best interest of the majority ahead. I see it all the time. It's on TV all the time. In entertainment and in politics, I mean, I'm not trying to offend anyone who calls themselves a black Republican. That's on you, but I'm just saying there's too many other black people out here that won't stick together. That's our problem. All the other ethnic groups do stick together. Black people don't. So that right there is going to stop the whole thing about us pulling together, because there's going to be some black people who are going to pull against that. Or either pull against it or indifferent to it.
Now, that's true, but we have to begin somewhere. We have to identify those who are like-minded and begin to work towards that in the hope that eventually they'll come on board. If Harriet Tubman and the rest of them had did the Underground Railroad, would have thought the same way. The Underground Railroad would have never came into existence. They knew who they could trust, and they knew who to share with, and they knew who to take with. And that's where we got to get back to. I'm sorry. And yeah, I'm a retired pastor, and the whole Western theology has put us in slavery, whereas our ancestors understood the spiritual things, and they dealt with it from that perspective, as opposed to a blue-eyed, blonde-haired, fair-skinned image that they said is God, and that looks like them. And whenever you look at the history, the Greeks said that they could not worship any being that did not look like them. And they didn't understand how anybody could worship anything that they never seen. That theology is what's being spread in the churches today.
Well, you know, I go back to what Martin Luther King said, and going back to what was just stated in terms of coming together. When Martin Luther King, you know, during his time, he mentioned the jealousy of black folks. Until we get past our jealousy, we as a people, it's going to be a while.
Yes.
And that's absolutely true. I mean, because we still have this tribalness in us.
Mm-hmm.
Many of us don't even know what tribes we came from. However, you came off that boat like everybody else. You know, so... You know, I'm sorry. I'm just saying. You know, you're in it. So, and until we come to that point, you know, because jealousy is a killer, and that's the killer of our communities, you know, the whole jealousy thing, or whose voice is being heard. And that's what I like when I listened to the director of the NAACP the other night, and he said, no, we're not a personality. We are an organization. We don't have personalities. I think that's what we need to get to that point in understanding that no matter where you go, no matter what you do, I mean, even if you make $400 million a year, you're going to have your obstacles.
Mm-hmm.
And they're seeing that, you know, the elite of us. And so, you know, it's just till we get to that point, I understand what that comment that Travis just made it just now. That's why. And it's sad, but as you stated, if we can get those who are on board, and if we can get the majority on board, then maybe it'll change the minds of some of us. You know, other than that, I don't know. You know, I don't really have an exact answer, but I know that we have to start somewhere. Anyone else? I know this is area code 44772. Who is that?
That is Evangelist Strong.
Okay.
I was trying to sit back and be a silent listener, but I will say this. It seems that I am in agreement, total agreement with everyone. I also see the problem as a much greater problem. I think we need to return back to the Lord, coming from a spiritual point of view. We have forgotten our first love, and we need, as I see it, we need stronger civil rights leaders. We don't have the civil rights leaders that we once had. And I look at Martin Luther King, and I even have to look into Malcolm X. I'm not a Muslim, but if you recall, he was moving in that direction where he stated that we need it as a black race. We need to develop our own communities, our own school, our own support system. And everyone was, you know, there were mixed feelings about that. But when you think about it, that's what we're forced to do. We know what we need. We know what our children need. And especially as us being, you know, I'll speak for myself, the older generation. We don't want to see our children go back. We want to see them progress. And if we don't start sticking together and start building communities, stronger black communities, and uniting together, that is exactly what's going to happen.
Yeah.
That's how I see it.
Yeah. That's absolutely true. And like
it's
I said
sad,
earlier, yeah, what is it going to take, though? I mean, so much has already happened.
It's going to take A lot of praying.
Yeah.
Praying and educating our children, making, you know, getting them into the scripture and giving them a sense of identity of themselves, where they came from and what they are capable of doing.
Yes. Yeah, it starts in our community, one person at a time. Community building,
yeah.
One person at a time, one church at a time, one whatever that is, organizations in your community at a time.
Yeah.
Because once you get a hold of your own community, then there's nothing that can stop you. You know, once you get a hold of your young people within that community and get them strong and build them up.
That's
and
right.
Say, hey, go out there. This is what we need you, you know.
And you know, it's a shame because they've given us, it looks good, you know, as Apostle Armstrong was saying, they've given you enough to be appealing, you know, to appeal to the younger generation. The younger generation now is appealed to what's going on around them, you know. It looks good.
Yeah.
But now they're taking it away.
Yeah.
What are they going to do?
I don't know. That's what we're trying to figure out.
You know?
It's like, but I think there's enough where this generation has so much information, so much. And I think a wealth of it, and they're very discerning, you know, and I believe that they will find other means and other ways. But right now, and that's for all, not just minorities, but for young people today, period, there's just too much distraction, too many distractions.
Yeah.
And as long as they're distracted and they can't see, I mean, they
mm-hmm.
know something is going on, but they, you know, they can't seem to see their way. They need to find out how to be more innovative versus reactive to things.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
AKA Black Lives Matter, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to find. I think these things are happening for a reason to push us in the. To where we need to be.
Well,
so
exactly.
You know, nothing. Yeah. Hello.
Hello.
Oh, okay. I thought you were going to say something.
Oh no. I was just agreeing with you.
Okay. All right. Well, it's about time for me to wrap it up. But I want to thank you guys for calling in. Thank you for your words of wisdom. Thank you for coming on. This is a fight that we're going to have to continue. And with the help of God, it's only by faith. Because,
only by God.
Yeah, so we just have to continue to march on, continue to fight on, but also have resolutions to our situation, to be innovators, to be creators. And many of us are doing that. So anyway, time for me to go. Peace and blessings.
God bless you.
Thank you. God bless you.